Hello, and welcome to the Your Gateway to Wealth and Fulfillment podcast. I'm Andrew Kittleson, Senior Vice President with UBS in Charlotte, North Carolina. We can be reached at 704-362-8260. Very excited today to have our guest, Dennis Kouroussis, who's co-founder of one company, founder of another.
Co-founder in that one too.
Okay. Very excited to have you here and for this discussion. Dennis's views and perspective are his own and not UBS's. And with that, welcome, Dennis. I'm very excited to learn about your businesses, but like to start with you as a person and kind of your influences in becoming an entrepreneur. I know your father was very much an important influence in your life. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and getting started in what you're doing?
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you for the opportunity. You know, we immigrated to Canada when I was 6 years old. My father was a mining engineer. And I think one of his first, and this was in the 80s, so I'm dating myself, one of his first jobs was in Northern Ontario as a mining engineer. And then there was a recession. So we ended up in Toronto. You know, he was looking for jobs. There were no jobs at the time. And ultimately, he started, somehow he ended up doing like door-to-door sales with Electrolux at the time, I think, like vacuum cleaner sales. And through that cold calling that he was doing, he actually ran into another buddy of his from the army in Greece. And his buddy told him, well, you're wasting your time. Why don't you try to start a cleaning business? Because that was popular within the Greek community back then in the 80s. And my father actually attempted it. And within 6 months, he had a small business up and running, cleaning offices. And over time, I ended up in that business as a kid, like vacuuming, cleaning washrooms, and so forth. So that was kind of the spark on the entrepreneurial side to, you know, who cares about title, just do the work and invoice and create a living, so to speak. So that's how it all started. But because my father was an engineer by training, it was really important that I continue on to school and go do engineering and so forth, which the story I like to tell people, in the 90s, I could strip and wax floors and make probably $1,000 a day. I had to go to school, right? So it would have been a different story if I had taken over the cleaning business potentially, but you know, that's what it is.
Good. What was the path from getting your degrees? Because you have multiple degrees.
Sure. Yeah.
Did you work for someone else and then start your business, or did you start kind of out of school?
So a little bit on the engineering side, I always had a passion for cars. I love cars since I was, I don't know, 4 years old or something like that. So I think when I was maybe five, I saw the internals of the internal combustion engine, like the pistons and everything. And I found that fascinating. So engineering was kind of like a fit for me. And I think when I was 14 or 15, I was actually dabbling in cars, like my dad's cars, and fixing them a little bit. One of the things that I had taken apart was the fuel injection computer, one of the first of its kind. And I saw a whole bunch of microchips and I go, wow, this is fascinating. I really want to go study this. So that's how I ended up in electrical engineering specifically. Undergrad, I did power and power systems, rotating machinery. I found that fascinating. Masters, I did a power electronics thesis. I actually built a 50 kVA arc lamp system, multiple power supplies, and all the firmware behind it. So that was a fascinating project to work on. And then when I graduated, there were no jobs in power so much back then. I ended up in the semiconductor company called ATI, the competitor to NVIDIA at the time, a graphics chip manufacturer, and I ended up in the semiconductor industry. So I worked there for a couple of years, and then I went back and did a PhD in CAD tools for VLSI. So this is on the software development for engineering layout on the actual semiconductors. So that's the quick summary. After the PhD, I did go back to ATI, worked for a couple of years again. And then I ended up in a Silicon Valley startup that had commercialized my PhD thesis in parallel, like no significant overlap. And I worked for them for about a year and I kind of got the bug. Like I had the entrepreneurial background from the cleaning business back in the day. And I saw that this team had built a software platform that was being used by Intel, Broadcom, and a bunch of other companies, including ATI. That's how I met these people. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do this on my own at some point. So that's where the whole journey, entrepreneurship journey began.
Okay, then you go start your own company by yourself and have to build out your team. I'm sure you've learned a number of lessons.
A lot of lessons.
Hiring people and maybe having to let people go and just getting the right people around you and allowing them to do what they do well.
Yes. So in the early days, clearly I didn't know what I was doing. I'd like to make that bold statement or a very true statement. You know, I started a company in 2009, Volta Energy, to do EV charging, believe it or not, way ahead of its time. So we actually built a little bit of technology to do demand management. If the chargers are all out there in the field in one location, you're going to get overloading on your transformer upstream. Had a small team of engineers. We built some stuff. I didn't know how to sell it. I didn't know how to get traction. Ran out of money. We had raised a little bit of money from friends and family at that time. And once I saw the bank account decreasing, even though we had built some technology, I didn't know what to do next. I couldn't raise money at the time. That was not something I had experience with. So I had to downsize. My friends all understood. My engineers, who were also my friends at the time, all understood. That kind of sent them home. And I started consulting and contracting as a solopreneur in the moment. So we got started getting a couple of jobs. And then I think I hired my first engineer to support me after a few years. But it was in the data center space. And that's how I kept going for a number of years until met a couple of partnerships. We started Atom Power with Ryan Kennedy, a co-founder at that time, and then built that first company. And it was an interesting learning experience, right? In terms of putting the right people around you, absolutely. I mean, that will either create a significant impact in the marketplace with good culture, or, you know, you're not going to win effectively. So
you'd mentioned data centers, which obviously are AI. Yes. Data centers are where so many people are focused now. And from my understanding, you know, our energy demand only increases by a few percent a year, but we're now starting to see that spike with the demand from data centers. You know, we did a podcast with Ryan and Atom Power and how they fit into the sort of power system ecosystem. Can we talk a bit about Volta, right? Because you're in the kind of data management, data collection, trying to get ahead of power problems and issues by making electrical systems, you know, more reliable, safer, using predictive power analytics, using real-time electrical data. Tell us about that.
Sure. Absolutely. So Volta Insight is a cloud-based monitoring solution for critical electrical assets. It was actually born out of the consulting that I was doing as a solopreneur in the early days. I would get called in to certain manufacturing facilities or commercial facilities where people were having electrical problems and they didn't understand why they were having these problems. And in some cases, those problems would be really expensive. So a motor and VFD setup would be blowing up and they would have possibly replaced it twice at $100,000 a shot. You can't keep doing that, right? So, you know, I'd show up with oscilloscopes and different equipment and try to get all that data and try to understand, okay, this is the actual problem. You know, the idea for Volta Insight effectively came out of building a more intelligent system of that data collection on the electrical side. So we have our own sensor, let's call it, that measures voltage and current in high frequency. So you have continuous waveform capture. And then we've built that intelligence in the cloud to be able to analyze, like an electrical engineer, the waveforms and come up with predictions and recommendations as to what needs to get addressed before it gets even worse and creates a catastrophic failure potentially.
Well, we early on, kind of early innings of what you do with this data collection, and I've heard this term, fault library of data. So I imagine that's collecting information from these different systems that continues to grow, that ultimately makes it even more efficient. Am I understanding that correctly?
Absolutely, yes. So every piece of equipment has its own operational electrical signature, fundamentally. And so there's two aspects. One is power is provided to the piece of equipment through the voltage that you give it, and it consumes power through the current that it uses, right? So if you look at voltage, it's an indicator of what is happening upstream on your electrical system. And if you look at current, it's what is happening on the actual piece of equipment. So by using some algorithms and some intelligence, now you can build up the library, as you call it, for specific pieces of equipment and say, I'll use two examples. One is a voltage variation, a transient, a small transient that happens on the voltage. That could be a contactor, right? Your startup contactor for your, you know, chiller motor, for example. And then if you see something like a single phasing event where your voltage in and of itself is fine, so you see current that single phases, then it means something is happening downstream. So probably at your motor itself is shorting out. So these are things that we have built up over time. And for different pieces of equipment, right, including large manufacturing, hydraulic couplings, like you can see all kinds of degradation throughout the system. So if you can catch it early, you can prevent a lot of catastrophic failure.
Some of these failures that the industry was not able to identify before, I've heard this term, ghost electrical problems, is that yes. Collecting this data is ultimately kind of really exposing those problems and the ability to address them, like you said, before
yes.
They become too big of a problem and
correct.
Too expensive.
Correct. So there's the ghost electrical problems are typically transient events. Something is happening on your electrical system that no one can identify, no one can understand. And it can come from a number of different things. In a large manufacturing facility, one example is if you have two large induction motors in your process and you start up an induction motor and then you start up the second induction motor around the same time, you may collapse the voltage. There's too much inrush current, but you may not know that in a large facility that this is happening. So just having that instantaneous data and the alert that this is happening, you can just go and potentially fix in your PLCs and your process software to just delay the start of one motor, and it makes those ghost electrical problems go away, right? So that voltage collapse is uniquely a consequence of something happening, but no one understands why. But if you have the electrical data, you can go back and pinpoint exactly what happened.
Okay, so if we bring that to, let's say, a real life example, and obviously energy and power is such an important component to our economy, moving products and people around the planet. And fairly recently, we had like a shutdown at Heathrow Airport, which I believe was maybe due to the failure of a power station. In an example like that, how could Volta have helped?
Sure. So I don't know the exact details of the failure. It's only whatever minimally I heard through the news. I think there were a couple of problems. One was that it was a substation. There was no redundancy to the substation. And most likely it was overloading or there was some kind of shorting that happened within the transformer, for example. In my mind, in this world, nothing fails absolutely catastrophically immediately. There's always some indicator on the front end of that. So in my opinion, if there was real-time monitoring, if there was high-resolution real-time monitoring on the voltage and current of that substation, there would have been some early indicators through voltage transients, let's call it, or some intermittency that would have been seen in the electrical signature. And that could have been addressed way in advance before that catastrophic failure happened. So that's something that absolutely, in my mind, could have been prevented.
And preventing that, obviously, if you're Heathrow Airport and you're down for a while, that's a tremendous amount of downtime. You're losing money. So any business that experiences that downtime, that's going to affect their bottom line. So you're able to help prevent that. Is there a way to quantify it?
Absolutely. So some of our bigger customers in manufacturing, the examples I like to use, okay, we can prevent or we can predict when something might fail. We can eliminate the cost of an induction motor failure, which might be $20,000, right? So the motor might start single phasing, we catch it early, we send out a technician, tightens down some lugs or changes a contactor, it's a $200 replacement. If that motor were to go into single phasing during loading conditions and fail, it would be a $20,000 motor rebuild, for example. That's not the biggest cost. The biggest cost is the 8 hours of downtime to actually replace that motor. And if you're a big manufacturing facility, that might be $100,000 an hour. So now we're talking almost $1 million of production losses. And that's what really we're addressing with our solution.
You mentioned manufacturing facilities. Are they, because I immediately think of data centers, manufacturing facilities, what other kind of customers, applications? I know power is in everything, so you might say it
could be any industry. Any industry that has criticality behind it, right? So healthcare, we're in a few hospitals at this point. Infrastructure, power, whether it's pumping facilities for utilities, moving water, moving oil and gas potentially through pipelines. Data centers are a big one. You know, anything that's critical and you need it to operate 24/7 and you can't get that time back if it goes down. Yeah, absolutely. That's where we fit.
Okay. It's a lot of applications, it seems. You mentioned technicians. I know within the electrical industry and other trades, right, we have a shortage of people in those trades.
Massive shortage from what I understand.
Yeah. So particularly if a lot of these data centers, I know I keep going back to data centers, it might be in rural areas where there's already a lack of trades folks. And if you have an area like that where there's not the talent, say, to work on this new equipment that keeps evolving, that's certainly something where I would imagine, you know, Volta and your products and services can help mitigate that lack of talent, right?
Yes, absolutely. So especially within data centers, you can now, traditional colos, as they're called, colocation data centers, they might be 3 or 4 megawatts. But now the new AI factories, as they're called, they're starting to be 100 megawatts. There's talk about a gigawatt data center. And what you need to realize and almost appreciate, quite honestly, is they're very lean in terms of human staffing within these locations. So you might have a 100 megawatt facility with only a few electricians, a handful of electricians. So there's a lot of electrical assets within that facility, especially if you're looking at something like a megawatt rack density power that's coming down the pipe at this point in the new data center designs. So now you have liquid cooling and, you know, you need pumps to run that liquid cooling. You want to ensure all that electrical infrastructure is pristine and up and running. And how do you diagnose if something's misbehaving early on? I think you need a solution. So those technicians, part of the way we've designed our solution is to just monitor. There's no human intervention. If something goes wrong, an email gets sent out to the individual that needs to take care of that asset, and they can go and specifically put eyes on it and address the issue early on. It's a massive sort of jump in this maintenance category of electrical systems, right? Especially when there's no people able to do the maintenance.
Okay. If I'm building a facility, manufacturing facility, or a data center, and I'm looking at what equipment to put in there, what's more important, or what's the order of operations? Should I be figuring out what equipment I need to build this and then attach the monitoring system to it? Or should I be thinking about the monitoring system first and then, and I'm not in this industry, right, so I might not be asking this question the right way.
It's an interesting question. I haven't thought about it that way, but it's a good question. I would say that go build out what you need. And then the way typically that any manufacturing facility or any data center is designed, there's some electrical drawings, right? The engineer will spec out stuff depending on the needs, right? Possibly on a data center, you start at the rack and then you work backwards. How many racks you have? How much power does it need? You know, define your gen sets. I think all that is good. And I think that's still the way to design things. One of the projects that we're working on is using our tool to characterize the 1 megawatt rack that's coming from NVIDIA, the Blackwells, and understand that load profile for a specific use case. So if we can do that, now you have even more data to be able to go back and work backwards to build your data center, for example. So if you have the ability to characterize something, your loads, and then you can go back and design, that's great. If you can't do that, then deploy us anyway on commissioning, and we can help ensure that the beginning design actually makes sense, if that makes sense as an answer.
Yeah, it does. Thank you. So I don't know how you do what you do. You're running two companies right now, you know, Adam Power and Volta.
I
appreciate, again, you taking fitting us in and taking the time. Related to a power system, how do the two work together? Let's say, could you have Adam Power and Volta working together in a particular facility?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of synergy moving forward, potentially. So Adam Power developed the world's first solid-state circuit breaker, so it's in circuit protection. You know, the new data center architecture that's coming down the pipe is an 800-volt DC architecture. So the idea is to distribute 800 volts to each and every single rack. When you go to 800 volts DC, protection becomes harder. DC protection on circuit side is harder because there's never a zero crossing. So realistically, the only solution that exists is a solid state circuit breaker for that application. So now we have, maybe the timing is just right for us somehow. We lucked into it. I don't know. But our solid state circuit breaker now has a very unique application where the cost kind of makes sense, right? It's a more expensive product. And from the Volta Insight side, if you have a granular high level of monitoring, now you can actually characterize your loads and understand your loads better on a very granular level so that you can ensure that the electrical distribution is up and running continuously, right? So we can build a lot of resilience in the system by using good protection and monitoring, in my opinion. There's quite a bit of overlap in this game of uptime for the data centers.
Okay. And between these two businesses, from my experience working with a lot of entrepreneurs, and you touched on it early on, you didn't know exactly what you were doing. And a lot of it is learning on the fly and learning as you go. And again, building the right team, you know, to give them the autonomy and help you really leverage growing the business. Are there lessons that you learn from each one of these businesses that you apply to the other?
All the time. You know, I think as advice to entrepreneurs, try to stay lean for as long as you can. Not having loads of money is sometimes a benefit. It's a blessing because it makes you efficient and it keeps your team efficient as well, right? And you have to solve problems. Maybe taking a step back, right? What is the market demand for whatever it is you're doing? That's the first thing that you should focus on as an entrepreneur. What value are you creating in the marketplace? And then how can you create that value at the lowest cost so that there's adoption? And in order to do that, guess what? You need to be lean as a team, right? So you need to be efficient as a team.
Right.
I think that's the biggest lessons that I kind of concluded over time without anyone having to teach me that necessarily, right?
You learned a lot from your father, sounds like, but most of it you've learned kind of on the fly.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yes.
You don't learn it in the
sink or swim.
Yeah. Any other, as we wrap up, any other advice for, say, young entrepreneurs out there that are getting going? You just gave a good couple good pieces of advice. Anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, I try to tell people, stay away from entrepreneurship. It's very difficult. You may not like it. However, a more realistic approach is you could be an intrapreneur within a lot of organizations, large and small. If you can find that team that's already building something amazing and join that team at the startup level, you have a higher probability of success than if you try to go at it on your own, right? Less painful,
right?
Let's call it. So maybe that's an approach.
Okay.
Right.
So letting somebody else make the initial mistakes and—
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Very good. Well, this has been a great conversation, Dennis. I really, again, appreciate the time and wish you all the success in the world. Very excited to see where things go and as they're moving so rapidly in our world, you know, with AI, with these data centers and the need for power. Your work is very important and we appreciate what you're doing. So thank you very much.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.